This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's Health and Living and I'm Mira Sivasodhi. In the studio with us are the specialists from University Malaya Specialist Centre, UMSC. And today our topic for discussion is something that's very close to my heart and something I've always wanted to put on the table and thrash out and what more with these beautiful women. It's whether we should screen or not when it comes to our health. Joining me, Professor Dr. April Camilla Ruslani. She's a consultant colorectal surgeon and associate Professor Dr. Aizura Shafinaz Ahmad Adlan. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist. I'm both from UMSC. Welcome to the show, ladies. How
Thank
are you today?
Very good.
Very
pleased
good,
to
very
be
good.
Here. Yeah.
You know, screening tests are typically given to people who are seemingly fit, right? We always try to make that distinction on the show that screening versus diagnosis are two very different things. Diagnosis, you're already looking, something already doesn't look quite right. You're going in to figure out what's actually wrong. Screening means you're perfectly all right. You're just going to go in and try and figure out if you are healthy and everything is going as it should be. That is such a layperson's interpretation of what screening versus diagnosis is. But what exactly would you say, in your opinion, Professor Aizura, as to what health screening really is?
I think basically it's just like identifying these healthy people to see whether they are at risk or at least are they, you know, at an increased risk of a certain disease or not. That's basically it. They're generally a healthy cohort. So we need to know, you know, it's more of like a, can we prevent something before it even happens? So the general population targeted for screening is, of course, those who are healthy.
And that's a lot of people.
Exactly.
So what does that mean, Professor April?
Well, coming from an academic centre, obviously we have to be guided by certain principles when we do anything. And Aizura's right that in general, the patients or the people that we consider for screening are those that have no symptoms. So it's an asymptomatic population, but there is something about them that based on our previous studies, we know that they are perhaps at higher risk than the average person for developing certain types of diseases. So perhaps if I gave you an example, for instance, colorectal cancer is one of the commonest cancers in the country, and we know that the incidence increases with age. Therefore, the people that we would target are those that are of the age of 50 or above, because we know that the incidence actually rises exponentially after that age.
Yep. So colorectal cancer being the leading cancer amongst men, am I correct? The number one cause of cancer amongst men and the number two amongst women.
Women after breast.
After breast cancer. So it is really up there. And, you know, but so should majority of the population that's 50 and above go and screen for colorectal cancer, would you say, Professor April?
So I would say simplistically the answer would be no, because there is a target population for screening, and for colorectal cancer that target group is those who are 50 and above. Now there are other factors that can lead us to wanting to screen a certain section of the population earlier than the age of 50 years. And this is usually if they have some sort of risk factor, like a family history, a strong family history of colorectal cancer, or perhaps if they've got some other conditions that predispose them to a higher risk of cancer.
Okay, so you need to ask yourself these sort of questions, right? Mm-hmm. But that's the thing, Professor April. Most people wouldn't come and see you and get a family history taken and then say, you know, Professor April, should I be screened? We're probably just going to go sign up for a whole health screening package and like, you know, hope for the best. You know, some of us don't even know what that health screening package entails. What are your thoughts on that? What are principles of screening for a disease?
Screening of a disease has to be simple, reliable, and there is a treatment that can be done if you detect something. Basically, it has to be repeatable, simple, and cost-friendly. So I feel that we should screen when there are certain risk factors which predetermines you to do that screening. But there are a lot of packages out there which just do like a check girl list, you know, like everything is included from your full blood count right up to all the radiological screening that they do. That is the problem that we have. in most of the time.
I agree. And the other two things that should be considered with any sort of screening are that, number one, by doing the screening, you can actually make a difference to the outcomes. So one of the reasons why we screen for, say, breast cancer or for colorectal cancer is that we have shown that you can actually change either the survival or you can change, like, the point of intervention. So it's only if you can do something about it and make
if
a difference that it's ethical to screen.
That's right.
Okay, so that's example, a really important point.
Like cervical cancer, okay, the second most cancer after breast cancer, at least in Malaysia. We have a pre-invasive state, meaning to say if you screen early enough, there is a state which is not even cancer yet, which we can rectify. So that's good. It goes before being a cancer, and we can eliminate that. So
it's
that's
like an inflammation state before
inflammation
it becomes pre-cancerous.
Yeah, that's right. It's a pre-cancerous state. Mm-hmm. And that's very helpful for people to know.
And then you might even be able to avoid a
big
operation,
yeah,
you know.
Right.
So
it's
that's really, really important that you can do something about it and actually change the outcome.
Okay.
Okay. The second thing that I was going to mention is that whatever test you use for screening has to not only be cost-effective, but it has to be a test that is safe, that doesn't cause harm to the patients or to the screened population, or at least it doesn't cause too much harm. The benefit must outweigh the risk.
Okay. The benefits must outweigh the risk.
Could you give me an example? So let's take mammograms for an example, right?
Yeah.
Everyone's encouraged. Am I correct in saying everyone's encouraged? Women are encouraged to do mammograms.
I think mammograms are also...
It's still age-related.
Yeah, it is age-related to like about 45 to till you're about 70 or so.
Okay. So in Malaysia, the guidelines for breast cancer are mammogram from the age of 50 to 74. In some other countries, they actually start earlier. The US now 45. Is starting at the age of 40. But because of our own local epidemiological data, we're still sticking to 50 to 74. Those were the guidelines for Malaysia.
Okay. Yeah. All right. We have a question here from Daniel. Daniel is saying, will you consider using risk assessment as to compare to screening?
I'd be interested to know what he means by risk assessment.
Okay, Daniel, can you tell us what you mean by risk assessment? Maybe, could it possibly be family history, looking at your risks that way versus going for screening immediately from there?
So it could be that, but we also have available in some places where you can actually do gene panels. So you can actually run a gene panel for yourself, and based on certain criteria, you may then be able to come up with a risk percentage for a particular kind of cancer. But, you know, they are risk assessments. They still are not diagnostic.
That's right.
And ultimately, you still will have to undergo the usual investigations to determine whether or not you have a disease.
Fair
I'll give
enough.
You an example, like thalassemia. Are we going to screen everybody for thalassemia? That's also a screening thing.
Yep.
It's not related to cancer, but it's a common disease. See, so who gets thalassemia? Everybody in the family, once one is detected, right? We do that.
But you have carriers.
Yeah, we have
some
carriers.
Some families don't even know. Because
exactly. Yeah. But you might marry a carrier.
Absolutely.
And it may cause more problems.
Yes.
Now you have to do the genetic counselling, whether or not to have children.
Yeah.
Two minors can make a major sort of situation.
Okay. So let's just take thalassemia for an example. So what do we do now? What do we do? Do we all go and screen for thalassemia?
No, it's usually based on if there is a quantifiable risk. So usually there's an index case and they may have come into hospital for something unrelated.
In the antenatal setup, we do a routine full blood count investigation, right, when they are pregnant. So if you see somebody with a mean corpuscular volume or mean hemoglobin count, which is low, then you suspect, but you find out from the history. So not necessarily everybody gets screened for thalassemia, but if you are significantly anemic, you might.
That there's just something that, you know, raises the doctor's index of suspicion. So it's not like you're screening,
it's not a screening
vast populations.
Exactly.
No.
Okay. Yeah. We're discussing whether to screen or not. Everything you want to know about screening, you know, those packages you sign up for and to a whole load of blood tests and, you know, scans and radiography and imaging and, you know, the works. And then you get this thick report, which half of which you don't really understand what it really means. Give us a call if you have a question. The number is 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. How do you feel so far, Professor Ezra? How do your patients perceive the screening tests? And when they come to you, do they, what do you see? What do you read from them?
Well, when they do come with this package, serial tests and all that, I'm the one who's scratching my head, because most of the time they are the ones, they're actually normal, healthy people, and they come with a raised CA125 and they go like, "Doc, what's wrong with me?" I'm like, "Yeah, I don't know. You know, I've got to see what's wrong with you." And sometimes they come with full ultrasound reports already, but in the end, when they come to us, we still have to re-ultrasound them again for our own assessment. So sometimes it's a lot of repetition, and it might not be necessary.
Okay, so yeah. Daniel has, just to come back to that, Daniel has said that when he says risk assessment, he's talking about referring to people with a high risk, meaning, for an example, smokers for lung cancer, or maybe age-specific. But screening targets everyone, including the healthy population.
So that's the cholesterol, hypertension, diabetes, yes, issue.
Exactly.
But I can, right, I can give maybe an example, again, with colorectal cancer. Now, we have a screening program, and actually there are national guidelines on the indications for screening. So we have actually categorized those to be screened into three categories. There is the average risk, which is, you know, the average population over the age of 50 who have no particular family history or no other particular risk factors. Then you have the high risk, which are the ones that have a definite genetic abnormality that's running in the family, and so those go into the high risk category. But then you have intermediate risk, which has a little bit of, you know, maybe one family member had a colorectal cancer, or they've got risk factors like smoking, etc., etc. So we have slightly different interventions or slightly different screening tests for each of those categories.
Okay. Yeah. So when, you know, when Malaysians, well, if you're offered a package, chances are it's convincing. And, you know, you don't, you know, I think the reason we're talking about this today is because we have such a weak primary healthcare system. Would you agree with me? Because if everyone...
I'm not going to get my head on.
Because if everyone had a good GP, or if everybody had, you know, the system was strong enough, I think we'd have proper interaction with general practitioners and primary healthcare providers, and they would be advising us as to whether or not we should screen or not. The problem now is we're all just making decisions based... We're allowing other people to influence us in order to make these decisions. And so if somebody says to me, "Hey, you know, I think you should do this whole screening thing," and when it comes to your health and you know very little about it, you will say yes.
The package is very attractive because it's usually linked to a holiday.
Oh, really?
Yeah, some of it is mixed into a holiday package, like you get to stay at a hotel and at the same time, by the way, let's do a medical screening for you. So it's like, why not? And most of the time, they are, as you said, healthy people. So they feel that, you know, there's probably nothing wrong with me. I might as well get it done, grab it while I can.
I think this is where, you know, there's obvious conflict of interest when you're thinking about actually what is good for the population versus, you know, what the commercial interests are. So going back to your point about primary care, I think that in our country, we're quite unique in that there's quite a large segment of primary care that's provided by private practitioners.
Yes.
But if you look at primary care medicine in the public healthcare side, it's quite different. They have a limited budget and they have to provide healthcare for a large segment of the population. And therefore, any decisions they make about screening are based on the evidence, are based on proven outcomes. Okay, so if you were to go to a specialist in primary care medicine on the public healthcare side, you would get advice about what is appropriate for screening, etc.
Right.
And they wouldn't be giving you packages.
Yeah, I agree. If you realize the packages are being taken up by the ones who can pay. Mm-hmm. You don't get packages in the government hospitals. You don't get the package offers into the, you know, normal middle income group and all that. It's always In the private sector, for holidays, as I said, and people who can afford.
And sometimes the cost is attractive.
Yes, exactly.
You get so much thrown in for, you know,
it's value
a certain,
for money.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And you have, you know what? You've got nothing to lose.
Exactly, until you find something wrong.
Yeah.
But then it was effective. Then there was a good reason to scream.
There are potential things to lose because, you know, obviously when you have a slightly abnormal test result, that creates a lot of anxiety that potentially can affect your mental health.
Stress.
and
stress and anxiety.
You know, sometimes it may lead to even problems within the family if something has come up that was a bit unexpected.
Exactly.
And,
we have stories to tell. Exactly.
Really?
Yes,
tell me
one. For example, like... there was an old man who wanted to go for Hajj, and this was like a 70-year-old man, and suddenly the syphilis test comes back as positive, and now do we screen the makcik who's wife? Yeah. So it creates a lot of controversy. That could have been like an old theater.
It's not necessarily venereal.
So that's the problem. When you create that anxiety, now you might have to undergo an investigation, which is probably not even necessary.
And potentially harmful. I mean, we've certainly people who've just gone for a CT scan just because, you know, and then you find something we call an incidentaloma, small lesions. You're not quite sure what it is just by looking at it. So they end up undergoing some sort of invasive biopsy, etc. And it turns out that it's not malignant, but they may have suffered a complication from the biopsy procedure.
They could have suffered a complication from the contrast of the CT scan, for that matter.
Renal failure.
That's right, renal failure.
Anaphylaxis.
That's the incidentaloma. So, yeah.
Really?
So a lady who comes in for a dermoid cyst, suddenly we find that there is some pancreatic cyst, goes to see the surgeon, and then they have to do something about the pancreatic cyst, or do they or do they not, and it delays the surgery for the gynae issue and all that. So in the end, they go like, nothing, there's nothing wrong with you, aside from the original reason.
Yeah. So a lot of false positives, you're saying, sometimes.
Possibly. Yeah. And that's why we would really advocate that if you wanted to have any sort of screening done, you really should have a long discussion with your healthcare provider as to the risks and benefits and all these sort of hidden potential problems. Particularly for those tests that are not really proven to have, to change the outcome.
We'll come back and find out what are some of these tests that are not really proven. In the studio with me, Professor Dr. April Camilla Ruslani. She's a consultant colorectal surgeon and Associate Professor Dr. Aizura Shafinas Ahmad Adlan, an obstetrician and gynecologist, both from University of Malaya Specialist Centre. They're in the studio with me to help us understand what screening really is. I think whether we should screen or not, I mean, under what circumstance is screening necessary? When do these procedures cause more harm than good? Some of the questions we should be asking ourselves before signing up for some of these packages, actually. If you have a question, number to call is 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. In the studio with me, Professor Dr. April Camilla Ruslani. She's a consultant colorectal surgeon. Also joining me, Associate Professor Dr. Aizura Shafinas Ahmad Adlan. She's a consultant obstetrician and gynecologist, both from University of Malaya Specialist Centre. We are discussing whether to screen or not. I think this is something we've all done in the past at some stage. I've always had arguments with some doctors on air as to, you know, cancer markers and stuff like that, tumour markers. I've always been against doing those tests personally for myself as well, because I'm like, okay, what do I do if it's a false positive? That's unnecessary anxiety. But at the same time, there's this niggly thought that maybe that cancer marker might actually tell me something. How would you address that problem for me?
This is a major bugbear of mine.
I mean, please, take it away. I need an answer. Because some cases, it has been proved. It was actually positive.
Let me give you ovarian cancer, for example. Mm-hmm. Ovarian cancer does not have a proper screening method. Okay? There are no smears to be done. The only thing that gives you some highlight is probably a raised CA125. So I would advocate, instead of doing a CA125 routinely, come for a transvaginal scan, because it hits females who are above 50, 45 to 50 and above, right? So you can come for a transvaginal scan in which we can now have a look closely. If it is, if there's anything wrong with your ovaries at all.
So this is where you insert a probe
into the vagina. That's the kind of screening.
And you get to see the ovaries.
You do. Because by the time we actually do get to an ovarian cancer, because it is a retroperitoneal organ, so it's behind, right? We tend to detect it quite late. So if you leave it as of nothing, the stage is often always, you know, of an advanced stage. So we are worried about that too. So come, when you do your mammogram, when you do your pap smear, well, it's just an extra effort to just sit down and do the transvaginal scan.
Okay.
That's it. That's
when you
at
do
least
your
that.
Yearly gynae
if we
checks.
Find, that's right, if we find something, then we can do a CA125 to correlate whether there is any significance or not.
I mean, in general, tumor markers, these blood tests that you do, none of them, with perhaps one exception, are used as screening tools. They are not. And the reason is that they're not sensitive, nor are they specific enough. Okay, so you could have false positives, but you could also have false negatives. And I worry about the false negatives because you have a normal test, but actually you've got the cancer.
Got the cancer.
And you're falsely reassured. And therefore, you're less likely to turn up to your doctor until it's really beyond help.
CA125 is like only significant 50% of the time. So how's that? It's like, you know.
Yeah. Mm. And it's both false positives as well as false negatives.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just to go through again, to recap what you had mentioned earlier when it comes to a test as to the ethics and, you know, the objective of it. It must be simple. The test has got to be reliable. A treatment option has to be available based on for the outcomes. It needs to be cost effective.
Yeah.
It needs to be safe.
Yes.
And these tests need to be proven.
Yeah.
So that's, I think if you keep that in mind, those are some of the key questions you need to ask before doing these tests.
Mm-hmm.
What about gene tests? Those are quite a few now. I can see both of your eyes lighting up, and I know you want to share your thoughts with me because I have my thoughts as well. The probability that you may, you know, get something. Don't know whether you will, but
so
you may just spend the rest of your life worrying that you may get something.
So I'm going to make a distinction between the gene panels, which I talked about earlier, versus focused gene testing. And I'm going to refer to the latter, giving the example of hereditary colon cancers. So usually it involves an index case. So somebody's diagnosed with a colorectal cancer, and then there's something about them, like maybe they're really young, okay, and they've already developed a cancer, and you're thinking, could this be hereditary? Then you start asking them, you know, has anyone else in your family had this? And they say, yeah, you know, my three of my siblings and then my father and, you know, countless cousins and aunts have had this. And you're thinking, okay, this could be hereditary. And so you would then test what we call the index case, which is that patient, for certain well-known mutations, genetic mutations. Now, once you've identified yet that, yes, they've got that mutation, you then offer screening to the family members. So this is not a population-based screening. This is to the ones who are directly at risk. And that is where you could offer genetic testing to the family members.
That's a gene panel that you're talking about?
Not gene panel. No, this is very specific.
Focused.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So like Angelina Jolie, for an example, she had the BRCA gene and decided on a double mastectomy and, you know, she removed her ovaries. And I really thought it was quite a bit that she did, given that she carried the BRCA gene. But would that be an example of focused gene testing?
Yes. Yes, that would. And I think the Angelina effect, you know, is always
is that what
brought
it's
up.
Called?
Yes, it's called, and it's actually that term
Angelina
is used in medical
yep.
circles.
Yep.
And so everybody started thinking, oh, you know, I've got to have this, and then if I've got this, I've got to have a mastectomy, a prophylactic mastectomy. But, you know, she would have undergone quite extensive counseling, both regarding her genetic risk as well as all the other factors involved. And then she would have had extensive counseling about how much benefit having a prophylactic mastectomy would give her. And subsequently for the ovarian risk as well,
yeah,
she would have undergone that as well. So it's not something like, okay, you have BRCA,
By
therefore
the way,
you have,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So genetic counselling, we've spoken about that at length. Yes. For families who want to do it. It's not as simple. You do it before you do the test. You get counselling after you do the test, you know, when you get the outcomes and stuff like that. But do you think generally counselling, people should have counselling before they do any sort of screening?
Definitely, definitely.
Yeah. And who should be that person to provide the counselling? Because you have specifically trained genetic counsellors when you do these gene tests, but
I'll throw it to you. Now, if you are higher risk of getting Down syndrome, if you're pregnant, who is going to counsel the patient that if you do this test, okay, we may see whether you are at high risk of getting a Down syndrome baby. Okay, let's do the test. But the counseling has to come. If you do get a Down syndrome child or baby, are you going to terminate it? Because termination is not allowed in this country.
Correct.
You see, so now where do we go from there?
Yeah.
So it's not
isn't
just
termination allowed in certain
circumstances? Not
certain
for Down syndrome.
Ah, okay.
So, you know, it's not just about the test itself.
Exactly. So if you are going to terminate where that is not of my concern, okay, because I cannot do the termination, for example, then you can do the test and you have to go back with the results and decide what to do. But if you're not going to terminate anyway, then what's the point of doing the test? It's expensive. Yeah, it gives you an idea. Some people will justify it by saying, okay, we will prepare for the future. All right, okay. Then
Fair
they
enough.
Get it done.
Yeah. I have a colleague who did that test and it was positive and all she did is cry till she gave birth.
For the next 7-8 months,
and
right?
She had a normal child.
Exactly.
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 So I said, you cried all those months.
See, that test, that test that she did, it should have been followed up with a chorionic villus sampling or an amniocentesis, which would have been definite. That should not have been the results that she would have gotten.
Yeah.
But that's not invasive.
But it's not an easy decision
to make. No, it is not.
It isn't, because you're told you're 35 and above, you're at higher risk, you should do it. And so then, you know, you think doctors know better and so you really should be doing it. But that was exactly what I asked her when she was going to do it. I said, are you going to terminate if you find out it's positive? And she said, no. Then I asked her, why are you doing the test?
In the first place?
She said, oh, I don't know. I need to know. People are confused.
Exactly.
You need to walk them through their thoughts. It's very
like
important.
Just like how Prof. April said that with CA colon, there are genetic predispositions to that. But, for example, the public also need to know what are your risks. Like in cervical cancer, it's not related to a genetic, you know, there's no genetic association. It's a virus. So who gets the virus? It's not passed down from generation to generation as such.
And hepatitis B as well.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Just simple things, right? Daniel is asking, hi, Prof, would you think panel testing will be better? Example, CA125 can be complemented by HE4 to increase specificity. Daniel really knows what he's talking about. But what's he talking about?
That's yours and mine. It's
yours.
No, it's mine. CA125. I think we just mentioned that just now.
Yes.
I don't agree in doing tumour markers just based on that. I would want to see the patient and do, involve other radiological investigation as well, risk factors as such, and not just the tumour markers and linking it to another tumour marker and linking it to another genetic. No, I wouldn't do that.
And remember, we talked about that not only must it be able to pick up, but it has to be shown to have changed the outcome. And tumour markers have not been shown, even those panels have not been shown to change the outcomes of ovarian cancer.
Okay. All right then. Jason is asking, should health screening be regulated? Regulate the indication despite paying out of pocket.
You want to take it?
I mean, you know, if you're paying it, then if you can afford it, go ahead. You can. But if, let's say, it's the public money, the taxpayers' money, then I think it should be regulated. Only the necessary ones. So at least the high risk ones, which will prove some change if detected.
But that's what's happening right now.
Well, I think even if you're paying out of pocket, I think the onus is on the healthcare providers to provide adequate counselling before somebody decides to pay for
a
test. Because, you know, the public is relying on doctors to tell them whether it's useful or not. And without that kind of information, how can they make an informed decision? That it's worth the money
informed
that they're paying.
Decision and consent.
You know, and then to have something that potentially could be harmful to them And then the downstream consequences of that, you know, things like, will you be covered by insurance if you're found to have a genetic abnormality or HIV or any of those things?
Yeah.
You know, if no one's talking to you about this, then they shouldn't be taking your money for screening.
Okay, so let's talk about the insurance part of things. And when you find out, what are the implications so far, professors? I mean, could you share an experience where insurance did come into play and, you know, the patient has been at a disadvantage because of the screening?
I can certainly mention in the context of some research that we have done, not my research personally, but one of my colleagues. At the University of Malaya. And part of the study was that it would have involved identifying a genetic mutation. And there were a lot of extensive discussions about whether that would need to be revealed, because the patients would be told if they had it or not. Would that need to be revealed if they were applying for medical insurance? Because if it was revealed, then obviously their premium might have gone up, because they're almost guaranteed to develop a cancer at some point later in their life.
Or they choose not to cover anything in relation
to what such the finding a disease. Was. So if you have if you carry a BRCA, you have to declare that when you apply for the insurance. Now, I'm wondering whether the insurance company will cover for the breast cancer if she ever develops it.
Okay. All right. Interesting. So we're going to come back and continue this discussion on whether to screen or not. In the studio with me, the professors from University Malaya Specialist Centre. If you have a question for us, give us a call. The number is 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back. If you have just joined us, I'm Meera Sivasodhi. In our Health and Living segment today, we're discussing whether you should screen or not. And we're referring to health screening, including gene tests, as well as, you know, a whole lot of blood tests, images, imaging, and all of that that we actually do. We have orthopedic surgeons who come in and say, you know, the outcome of an MRI is just a shadow. But we're obsessed with the shadow. There might not be anything in that shadow, but we're reading into these shadows in a big way. And sometimes misdiagnosing what the problem really is as well. So it's a very interesting area to have this discussion. I know that even in the next 15 minutes, we're not going to be finished, but we'll get this conversation going. Professor Dr. April Camilla Roslani, a consultant colorectal surgeon, and Associate Professor Dr. Aizura Shafinaz Ahmad Adlan, consultant obstetrician and gynecologist from University of Malaya Specialist Centre, in the studio sharing their thoughts with us. So let's talk about this now. The fact that, do you think a large proportion of the Malaysian population gets screened? Do we have data for that? Whether private
short answer
or public?
Is no. Short answer is no.
Yeah. Okay. Short answer is no.
Because while we may be able to access information about that from the public healthcare sector, we would not have it for the private sector.
Okay. So we don't know.
We don't.
But given that, you know, we love our screening packages and all of that, I mean, based on what we hear, at least in the Klang Valley, and we're not the healthiest nation either. It doesn't really translate. What are we screening and are we ignoring the results?
Well,
or, you know, what's going on there?
Yeah, so that's quite an interesting
approach.
Yeah. So I can tell you what's happened certainly in colorectal cancer screening. Now, for us, because of the incidence of it in our general population, we advocate a fecal occult blood test as the first line of screening. Now, you know, this means you need to get your poo. You need to stick this kit into the poo and then get that tested. And then once the result comes back, if it's positive, you then need to go on to have a proper colonoscopy, which again involves, you know, having to cleanse your bowel, taking this medicine that will just completely give you diarrhea for the next couple of hours. And then you've got to have somebody stick a long, flexible tube up your bum.
Someone like you.
Someone like me. Mm-hmm. So obviously this is not very palatable to the vast...
Not at all. Sexy, exactly. Not attractive.
So if you can even get somebody to send you their poo just for the fecal occult blood test, chances are that even if it's positive, they might not want to come for the colonoscopy, you know, and that's if you even get them to send the poo in the first place. So it's just not attractive. We did a couple of community screening projects in the past so that you know, you offered them the test free, the first test, the fecal occult blood test. And what we found was that although people were quite amenable to having their stool tested if it was offered free, when they were positive and you said you had to come for a colonoscopy, you know, there was only about a third of them that were willing to do so.
And to think that this is the sort of test that needs to be done.
It needs to be done.
Because it's the leading cancer amongst men and second amongst women.
Yeah.
How do we do this? I mean, can't we just do a blood test?
It would be nice if we could.
I know. not till today. Yeah. Just take cervical cancer for that matter. We are still an opportunistic screening population. People who come to the antenatal clinic get offered a pap smear.
For free.
Yeah, I mean, you know, while we're checking your pregnancy, you know, we can offer you a pap smear. Or if you're in the gynae clinic for whatever reason, then we say, you know, have you gotten your pap smear done? But otherwise, we don't get a postcard like in Norway or something that, oh, you're due for your pap smear now or soon. Nothing of that. So if you're not aware or you're not worried, you won't even seek out for it.
So what's the problem? We're afraid? We think ignorance is bliss?
To a certain extent.
But at the same time, we love doing our blood
tests.
No
news is
good news. Extensive
stuff. We love doing our blood tests if it's free or cheap.
Hmm. And it's a relatively easy thing to do, to give some blood.
To get some blood. But if I was to ask you to put your, you know, give your poo, lie down, and I have to put a speculum in you, it is still semi-invasive in a way. So that becomes not attractive.
What's a win-win situation? Would you have a solution in your head?
Disease-specific, risk-specific.
How do other countries do it? How do they get their populations on board?
It's actually the same.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's actually... Well, certainly when it comes to things like having colonoscopies, right. You know, the uptake is... I think the targeted success rate is in the region of 60%, and there are not many countries that are achieving that.
Okay, so we're doing okay then.
We're not doing okay. We're much worse than 60%.
All right. And, you know, after all these extensive blood tests that people come, or tests, screening that they've done, and they come and see you, how do you, what is your recommendation? How do you interpret these results? Does it make your life more difficult? How do you guide them through that process? Because I do know where they offer these screening tests, usually after which you go and see a doctor and get counselling, or you get, you know, people to read those results for you. And when they come and see you, how do you sort of go through these results with them?
I would actually go through all the results, even if they're not specific to my specialty. Yeah. I would at least look to see if there was anything abnormal. And I would at least tell them, even if something looks like it's normal, that doesn't mean that, you know, everything is okay. But I can only tell you that the test is normal. But for the tests that are specialty specific, that are mine, then I would actually extensively counsel them as to what it might mean.
Yeah. I mean, they've come to us, and then we might as well now take it as a semi-investigative approach to it. The screening has been done. So after a screening, what needs to be done? Further investigation. Mm-hmm. So particularly to our specialities, that would be best. But generally, you would have to have a look at the screening and see if anything is wrong at all.
Okay. Yeah. And when do you think screening becomes a burden to the healthcare system?
So again, it's about looking at cost-benefit. For you to screen for a particular disease, that disease has to be a significant healthcare problem in that country, in that environment, such that if you were to detect the disease earlier... before it became symptomatic and you could do something about it, you might actually end up saving costs the downstream treatment. So, for instance, at the moment, most of our cancers, I think, are detected in late stages, stage 3, stage 4. Treating cancers in late stages is extremely expensive because it's not just about surgery. It's all the chemotherapy, the targeted therapies, etc., which cost a bomb just for one patient. So imagine if that's multiplied by 60, 70% of the diseased population. So if you could then save on all that by picking it up in the asymptomatic phase, prevent perhaps even the cancer from occurring, then that is worth doing.
Like in cervical cancer, people are moving towards HPV vaccination. That's what they offer in schools.
It's preventive.
Now. Yeah, it's preventive. So hopefully, you know, like Australia, maybe one day will become like, you know, the risk of having a cervical cancer in the country will be nil.
I mean, we are looking at eliminating it, isn't
eliminating
it?
Eliminating it, that's right.
Yeah, first we need to get the boys on board and get them all immunized. And all of this costs money.
That's right.
It really does cost
money.
But
I think the vaccination is probably more worthwhile than treating the cancer itself.
Yeah, for sure.
And so usually when national screening programs are rolled out, they would have done this
cost-effectiveness.
They would have done the cost analyses and would have shown that there is actually a benefit.
Some benefit at the end of the road. And plus the quality of life. I mean, if you have a cancer victim in your family, it affects not just the person, but also the whole family as well.
So what would you say are significant healthcare problems to our population?
Well, strangely enough,
if we should be looking at those and screening based on those, what would it be?
If you're talking about cancer, then of course the big ones are
going
to be breast cancer, colorectal cancer, prostate cancer to some extent.
True.
Other than cancers?
Other than cancers, what
I mean, heart disease is the number one killer amongst both.
Diabetes. So I think that's the other one that people are looking at rolling out screening for.
Dyslipidemia, cholesterol levels and such. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And do you think those, you know, that's the other thing, right? You get these numbers and then you have some groups of people who will say these numbers are, you know, they've put them there because, you know, there's a conspiracy theory because they want you to take a certain medication after that, you know.
You can choose to believe so.
You know, 10 years ago, the sort of trade-off was much higher. Now they've brought it down. How do we...
Well, it's prevention, isn't it? You have to, you know, it's healthy living and the way of life and all that.
But I think, you know,
my question is, what is
the commercial? you're talking about whether there's commercial interests that has read
linked
to
the outcome of the screening.
Right. But the way that screening works is that there would have been a whole body of work that had been done to kind of show that something is linked to something else. And the screening programs only come after that, right? So whichever way you look at it, even if, say, Company X is pushing some drug, but we're not looking at Company X's drug when we are deciding whether screening is needed or not.
Okay. I'm sure you get a lot of these questions.
No, not really.
What annoys you most? I mean, just share your experience with me when it comes to screening, Prof. Azura. What is it that you want to get out of your system and tell us that we should be aware of when it comes to screening?
I get upset when I find raised tumor markers and I don't know where to find the pathologies. That's as I said, you know, we'd be scratching our heads finding what's wrong with you. And they get sleepless nights as well because the blood markers are a little bit different as such. So yeah, that annoys me. But having said that, it's also not the patient's fault because, you know, she did the screening and it just happens to be that way. But, you know, generally 80% of the population who does the screening, nothing happens. They all get a nice book at the end of the year and they're feeling very happy about it. This 20% who come to me with this, what do I do with them? That annoys me. Okay. So yeah, that's why we need to be disease-specific to a certain extent, risk-specific to a certain extent.
Yeah, my beef is not with the patients. I mean, the patients are just doing what they were advised to do. I'll give you... My beef is basically with the providers.
Okay. Forgetting
I may not have
screening.
Many friends after this.
That's all right.
But for instance, you mentioned imaging, CT scans. Yes. The new kid on the block is PET CT. All right. And I was extremely distressed and disappointed to receive on my desk not too long ago a flyer from a company that's providing this test saying that it should be used for screening for all cancers.
Could you explain to us what a PET CT is?
So a CT scan, I think most people will know what a CT scan is. A PET CT is where just prior to having the scan done, you will be injected with a certain material,
positive
a contrast material,
topography.
That actually enhances...
Yeah. A dye.
It's not
contrast.
Really a dye. Well, I want to say
radio-labeled,
but then, you know, people might get very upset about that.
But it is, but it is.
Yeah, it is.
It is a radioisotopes. It's, you know, so radioactive material.
Yeah. So the way it works is that cancer cells are very metabolically active, and so they require a lot of glucose to function. And so in a PET CT, the material that's injected is basically glucose, which is tagged with this radio label. Okay, so therefore, the assumption is that these active cells will be taking up most of the glucose and therefore they will show up on the scan. All right? But you can see how it's not a direct link, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and there are other conditions that can also lead to an increased uptake of
glucose. It cannot be a screening because it's not simple, it's not cheap, right?
Yeah. Going back to the
basis, going back to the basis of screening, it's not a screening method.
It is not. It has never been proven for any cancer that it is screening.
So what is the application for a PET-CT?
So usually with a PET-CT, the way I would use it is that if you've done... let's say you've been diagnosed with a cancer, all right, and you've had the treatment, etc., and we know that your tumor marker before you had the treatment was high, so not diagnostically, you've already diagnosed it somewhere else, and then after the treatment, your tumor marker comes down, but then later you find that it's starting to come up. You've done your normal scans, maybe you can't find anything, you're trying to look for where this thing is. Then you might do a PET-CT. That's one example. The other example is...
Because it will take up the glucose and then you get to see it.
Yes.
It appears.
It'll give you an idea if there's a recurrence, you know.
Yeah. Or if, you know, you've done your tumour marker and it's raised, you've already been diagnosed previously, it's really high, you just can't find it, then you do a PET-CT. Or if you're planning quite a radical operation... Okay, the normal scans seem to suggest your disease is just confined to one area. But because this is such a radical operation with risks entailed, you want to be sure that it will do what it's meant to do, which is curative resection. So you might do a PET-CT then to make sure there's no, you know, occult deposits somewhere else, which would actually change your management plan.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So there is a place for it.
There
it's
is,
just
definitely.
Not in screening.
I don't do PET-CT.
Not in screening. No, I do them, but they are very, very much targeted.
For a specific reason.
Yeah, for a specific reason.
So let's go through that again. The sort of things you should be thinking about when you do a screening test. It has to be simple. It needs to be reliable. It needs to have a treatment option. If you know, you do find anything, it needs to be cost-effective. It needs to be safe. Right? Would you have a message for us, Professor? I wish I had a video to just show you what these two just did. Professor Aizura.
The message is, I think, see your doctor. Find out first what is necessary for you. Don't go for the, you know, total package and not knowing what you're in for. And you need to be informed before you give your consent for the screening. Otherwise, you might be opening a big Pandora's box and you don't know what has gotten into, you know, what else is needed to it. If you're going to put in for a screening, you might know there's certain risks that may, you know, give rise to certain investigations that might follow after that. So do it only if it is really necessary or really, you know, bothering you as such.
Professor April?
Yeah. Do it, but do it for the right reasons and speak to the right people.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
Professor Dr. April Camilla Ruslani, a consultant colorectal surgeon and associate professor, Dr. Aizura Shafinaz Ahmad Adlan, a consultant obstetrician and gynecologist from University of Malaya Specialist Centre, speaking to us about screening, health screening on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.